It's Ray Richardson on WLOB 100.5 FM.
Out in the street, it's 6 a.m. Another sleepless night. Three cups of coffee, but I can't clear my head from what went down last night. We both have our own little ways, but somehow we keep it together.
It is 8:35. If you're just heading out, it is snowing. The white stuff is falling. Just be careful. Again, if the new state budget was in effect and you have an accident, your ambulance ride, they will tax the ambulance service 6% of the cost. So, you know, we don't want that here, but so just try to stay safe. So you don't have to pay yet another tax to the tax master, to the tax collector. I should have played The Tax Man by the Beatles, but since she's a woman, that probably wouldn't work. Anyhow, what do you do? We're broadcasting live from the RowAutoGroup.com studio. Don't forget, our McVetty's Hearth and Home text line is 207-409-6172. You can find out more at stovesofmaine.com. So Caroline Leavitt, who is the youngest White House press secretary in American history, held her first press briefing from the press room of the White House. And, you know, unlike her predecessor, she got up and told the truth. She looked reporters in the eye. She did not blink incessantly. She committed herself to being honest with the press and expected the press to be honest with her. One of the people in the room was Christian Daytok. He is a reporter with the Washington Examiner, and he is joining us right now. Christian, good morning.
Good morning, Ray. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, I appreciate it very much, man. So you were there yesterday, and you actually asked a question of Caroline about eggs. Talk about what you asked, and why did you ask it?
Sure. Well, I asked Caroline Leavitt about President Trump's actions and directives to address these egg prices that we're seeing skyrocketing across the country. The reason I asked that question is because at the top of her briefing, Leavitt pointed to a number of EOs the president has signed since entering office, one of which directed all federal agencies to come up with ways to cut costs for American households. He obviously campaigned heavily on combating inflation. Arguably, it was the top issue of his platform. And I do think the American public want to see results. Again, Caroline, I think everything she said was factually accurate. The current prices we're seeing are a factor of, you know, the Biden administration's handling of bird flu, the culling of, you know, more than 100 million chickens dating back to 2022. And she also was correct that egg prices have been on the rise for the last 2 years. But I do think it's a new administration. It's an old but now new again president. And people want to know, how will this president tackle an issue that's impacting so many families across the country?
Yeah, it is a big issue. You pointed out rightfully 100 million hens have been destroyed through this avian flu. There are two strains of it. One is a recoverable strain. The other is not. And it seems like many poultry farmers have basically gone in and just said, we're going to get rid of our stock completely and start over. And the demand for eggs has not gone down, but the supply of eggs has gone down. So when you have a greater demand than supply, prices are going to go up. They were, as she rightfully pointed out, way up under Biden. And I'm not saying you, just so we're clear, but it seems like Hakeem Jeffries and other people in the Congress suddenly woke up to the price of eggs the day Donald Trump took office, but didn't realize for 4 years they were up dramatically under Joe Biden. It was kind of an interesting thing. Give me your thoughts on the press conference. Were you in the press briefing room when Karine Jean-Pierre was the press secretary?
I was. I was there for Karine's whole tenure. I was there for Jen Psaki's whole tenure. I got on the White House beat when Stephanie Grisham was President Trump's press secretary. She had no briefings. But then I was there for Kayleigh McEnany's entire tenure. And to be quite frank, I thought Caroline handled herself extremely well.
Yeah.
You take policy out of it. You take the politics out of it. And she sounded confident. She certainly sounded prepared. She sounded like she was privy to top-level conversations at the White House, which I think was a major stumbling block for Karine Jean-Pierre. You know, the Biden administration, I think, tried to use siloing Corrine as a way for her to not make news in the briefing room. She could say, oh, I don't have an answer for that, or I haven't spoken to the president about this today. But the way Caroline responded to the questions showed this White House team is pursuing a very different messaging strategy. Now, we will see if it will hold. Obviously, there are going to be people in the room who are extremely critical of this incoming administration on just about every move. But for a first press conference, a first press briefing, and again, like you said, for the youngest press secretary ever, I think you got to tip your cap to her. She did about just as well as they could have hoped.
Yeah, and I'm a little biased. Caroline is a personal friend of mine. We text back and forth a lot, and I just admire her. I admire her professionalism. I got to know her when she worked in the White House the first go-around, and then, of course, she ran for Congress a couple of years ago from the great state of New Hampshire. She's been a guest here, I don't even know how many times, 50, 100 times. But I've known her for a long time, and I expected what I saw yesterday. Had I seen something different, frankly, I would have been disappointed. But I think the tone is going to be different. I don't know if you know John Decker of Gray Television, but he's also a great friend of mine who was there. He's been at the White House press corps since 1995. John asked one of the questions in the audience yesterday as well. But I think there's a different feel already. And maybe the point is the one you made. They siloed KGP so that she really didn't have a lot of information and had to always refer back to, I'll get back to you. Whereas Caroline, much like Sarah Huckabee Sanders was, they were read in from the beginning, so they knew precisely what was happening.
Yeah, it was certainly a conscious choice, and I don't know if that, you know, came from Caroline pushing directly to have this sort of strategy, if it came from communications director Stephen Chung or Taylor Budowich or even President Trump himself. But it does seem like that whole team is on the same page, and it's that we want to present a united front. And the main mouthpiece for this administration, besides the president, needs to be keyed in on information and decisions so that she can communicate effectively to the public and also genuinely respond to questions from reporters. It was refreshing to see.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely, and I do think that that is their strategy. He certainly employed it with Sean Spicer. Sean is also a personal friend. He's a guy that's on the show every other Tuesday. He's talked a lot about that role, how it works, what is the best way to approach it. I want to get into some of the issues with you. As you know, the president has placed a spending freeze on the federal government. Yesterday, a judge came out and put a freeze on the freeze. There's a lot of concern around the country. Caroline was quite clear yesterday, I think on four occasions from questions, that individual payments were still going out, Social Security, Medicare, food stamps, welfare. She used those as examples. But there seems to be a lot of concern around the country, which to me says we don't have a recognition of the $36 trillion we're in debt. But what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, I'm not sure so much that this is a rejection of the idea that the U.S. needs to get its deficit under control. I think genuinely there was confusion because of the speed at which this was announced. And let's go back a second, because this order or directive came out Monday night, and it put a place in, or it put a ban on funding, a freeze on the funding in place for Tuesday at 5 p.m. Now, when Caroline was in the briefing room and was asked, you know, why not give NGOs or state and local organizations more advanced heads up, she essentially said, well, the memo was the heads up, and that's all you need to know. We gave you a day. But then later in the briefing, and I actually sort of did think this was potentially the one slip up that Caroline had, she was asked specifically if Meals on Wheels, the national food organization, would be impacted. And she said, you know, this memo just came out. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but I haven't had a chance to see all of the organizations impacted, but we'll get back to you with a specific list. I think that sort of zeroes in on the problem. Because shortly after the briefing, OMB did put out a secondary memo which clarified exactly which organizations or programs are exempt from this pause. It's programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, the housing program, both of which gave some states trouble with accessing the federal portal Tuesday morning. So again, I do think if there was more clarity up front, there would have been less of a backlash from even Democrats and these nonprofit organizations. And if you look to the district judge's taking up of this case, she put a stay in place, not because of the legality of the move, because, again, past presidents have done this. They have reviewed discretionary spending to see if it aligns with the priorities of their administration. But this judge said, we need to give NGOs more time to put their arguments together. If you can't come up with a coherent argument in a week for why this should be blocked, I'm going to let it move forward. So ultimately, and I do think this is a symptom of being a new administration, they're juggling a lot of balls right now. And to be honest, I don't even think anyone in Washington thought that the Trump team would address as many of these quote-unquote day one issues that the president promised to address on the campaign trail within the first week. So it's not surprising there are some hiccups here. And again, staff is still being brought on. I know the White House team just got their official emails on Monday. So the speed with which the Trump administration wants to address these issues, coupled with just the breadth and the wide range of topics that they're covering early on, contributed to the confusion. But as the dust has settled and states have seen that, again, Medicaid, Head Start, SNAP, any of these programs that are giving direct assistance to Americans, not necessarily NGOs, those will not be touched. Some of that fervor began to die down.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, look, the NGOs are always going to be upset because they believe that they are, in my opinion, far more important than they actually are. The president wants to address this. You heard Caroline in the briefing yesterday, Caroline Leavitt, say that we were about to send millions and millions of dollars to Gaza for condoms. And, you know, I think there was an outrage among Americans who heard that, when we know that there were veterans in this country sleeping in tents in the winter, when we know that there are people in North Carolina who are struggling sleeping in tents in the winter. I know the Asheville area very well, spent a lot of time there. I think Americans were outraged by that, just as they were when we found out the State Department was giving out grants to the Taliban that totaled almost $300 million. That small chump change in a $7 trillion budget, but to the American people, it's real money. So I'm glad to see these pauses and these let's take a look at what the heck we're actually doing, because if we don't do that, we're not going to address this $36 trillion debt that we have or the ongoing deficit that the CBO says will lead to $52 trillion in debt by 2032. Let me ask you this about the buyout package. I think a lot of people, I was surprised by it. I'm glad that he's offered it. If people don't want to come back to work, I show up every day. It's snowing here in Maine. I showed up this morning bright and early at 6 o'clock. I think people ought to go to work and treat their job like a job. But the president offered this buyout package that allows people by February 6th to accept it. And if they do, they'll get paid through September, including all of their benefits. What are reactions you're hearing on Capitol Hill about this?
You know, I haven't specifically spoken to lawmakers about this, but I have spoken to a number of career civil servants who were up in arms about this return to the office directive from President Trump. And I do think that this is a proper olive branch if the administration is truly serious about, one, shrinking the federal bureaucracy and overall spending, and two, bringing all of those remote workers who work for the federal government in the DMV area and even surrounding states back into downtown D.C. to revitalize what's really sort of a flagging commercial center since COVID. I think it shows that this isn't just blanket cruelty and they're trying to, you know, fire anyone who isn't a strident supporter of President Trump. It seems like a realistic business practice, the way they're doing this. And I have heard from a number of, we'll just call them civil servants. Some of them are sources. Some of them are friends and acquaintances, that they welcomed this idea. Now, there is still some confusion. Is this a true buyout in the sense that you are furloughed starting February 6th, but still getting paid out through September? Are you required to perform some duties? Again, we've got about a week until they have to make that decision, and more information will come out on the specifics. But overall, I think it's a good faith gesture on the part of the Trump administration in saying, hey, we're trying to clean up the government. but we're not doing it necessarily in the way that Democrats are claiming President Trump is trying to take over or institute, you know, societal change here in America.
Yeah, I agree with you. I looked at the details of it when it came out, and that was exactly what I thought. You used the phrase olive branch. That's exactly what I thought. You know, President Biden tried to make it where civil servants didn't have to come back into the buildings through 2029. I don't agree with that. I think we have a problem with that here in Maine with our state government, where too many state employees do not work in the buildings and they're not productive. And there's a lot of complaint about the lack of proper service by the civilians here. So I do think it's an olive branch. It's an opportunity to say, come back into work like you're supposed to, or you can make a different choice, but we're going to make that transition easy for you. And as I read through the details, I thought, frankly, it was a very generous offer here by the president. Long-term effect, they think maybe 5 to 10% may take this buyout. And long-term is we save $100 billion, which is, really a dramatic amount of money. I know in Washington that's chump change, pocket money. But for real people, that's a lot of money to see savings. $100 billion here, $100 billion there. Pretty soon we're talking about real money.
It adds up. And I do think, you know, smartly on the part of the administration, this also gives them time to vet new employees and backfill those positions. Because let's be honest, sure, it sounds great to say we're going to shrink the bureaucracy, but it takes a lot of people to get government up and moving, especially when you're trying to sort of institute all of these changes that the president is seeking and seeking to do rapidly. I do also kind of want to go to bat a little bit for some of these government employees. I think the idea that we're just calling them lazy and they don't want to go into the office, that's not exactly the full picture, because there is a real financial aspect to working from home for some of these people. When you talk about, you know, you can cut out the cost of childcare, you can cut out time on your daily commute. It's not just as black and white as, oh, they don't want to come into the office because they don't want to work hard. That might be true for some of them, but for the majority of the people that I've been speaking to who are up in arms about the return to work order, I do think there are other things on their mind. And this move from the Trump administration, again, shows we're thinking about these people. We're not just coming in and unhumanely sending people to breadlines. This is a real policy. And there's a real objective here. We've thought this thing through, and this is the best way to proceed forward.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. I've heard that argument, too. We've heard it here at the state level, that there's a commute cost, that there may be child care concerns, or you could, you know, you're saving money on child care. But if you're working from home and you've got your children running around, you're a distracted worker. And this came out of, obviously, COVID, when the government shut down the country and all of that. And I personally feel that it's being taken advantage of. Are there some jobs where whether you're at home or whether you're in the office, it doesn't matter? Of course there are. There are for everybody. For example, I mentioned this earlier today. It's snowing here in Maine. I could very easily do my show from my home, but I feel a responsibility to be in the studio so that my guests can come in and we can conduct a normal show. And I really feel like the government workers ought to have that same responsibility, which is why I like this. Now, it was offered to 2 million government employees. Obviously, if 2 million people took the buyout, we would be in trouble. But I do believe that our government employment is very bloated. And I think there are a lot of places that could be trimmed, but people don't even want to have the conversation. How much of a role, Christian, we're talking with Christian Daytalk of the Washington Examiner, who was in the press briefing room yesterday as Caroline Leavitt held her first White House press briefing. How much of a role do you think DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, as they begin to look at this, how much role do you think they'll be able to play with advice to the president about moves to make?
Well, when you talk about DOGE, you really have to talk about Elon Musk. And he certainly appears to have Donald Trump's ear right now. But there have been a couple of issues over the last several weeks, even dating back before the inauguration, where you sort of saw a little bit of separation. I mean, I think the H-1B visa debate was a great example of that. But again, you got to look at who is going to be leading the Office of Management and Budget, Russ Vought, who is probably going to be confirmed next week at the latest, certainly by February 10th, when this review process for federal grants was originally deadlined to be completed. And he certainly is a diehard proponent of shrinking the federal government. So those two men at the top of this push show that it's a priority for Donald Trump. I know they're both trusted confidants. I expect them to have an extremely close watch and heavily detailed report to Donald Trump about where cuts can be made, where we might need to perhaps expand the federal workforce to pursue the president's agenda effectively. They're going to be the drivers behind this thing, but ultimately everything is decided by the executive in the Trump administration, perhaps even more so than in administrations past, excuse me. So they will have a heavy hand in driving this thing, but it ultimately falls on the shoulders of Donald Trump where these cuts will actually fall.
Let me ask, we're running out of time. We're talking with Christian Daytalk of the Washington Examiner. By the way, this is your first time on the show. You've been a great guest, and I hope you'll come back frequently because you're well-informed. One thing I want to ask you, though, you mentioned about maybe a bit of a split between Musk and what have you, and you mentioned specifically the HB1 visas. I think that was maybe part of the MAGA nation being upset about it because we're trying to fight immigration here. But it didn't appear to be that there was a split between the president and Musk over it, because the president talked about using this HB1 visa and that he personally likes it. So was this more of a media creation to try to say there's sowing division, seeds of division? Because the president sided with Elon on this.
He did side with Elon, but when you look at Donald Trump as, let's say, an entertainer, he's used to being in the spotlight. And I'm not saying there is a real rift between the two of them, but when it comes to Elon Musk garnering headlines, you know, the focus, at least in my mind and in speaking to people in President Trump's orbit, should be on the chief executive, right? Look at what happened with Vivek Ramaswamy, who, again, was going to be one of those leaders of DOGE and has essentially been excommunicated to run for Ohio governor. I don't think that's necessarily because Donald Trump and Ramaswamy disagreed on the issues, but it might have just been Ramaswamy getting a little too big for his britches, taking a little bit too much of the spotlight. And, of course, the palace intrigue stuff certainly sells in the media. I will 100% give you that. There might be a manufactured narrative here, but just in my years of covering President Trump, when he sours on people in his orbit, it's generally because they are stealing headlines away from what he is trying to do. I think Elon's engagement in the H-1B debate, even though Donald Trump agrees with him philosophically, you know, sort of turned the MAGA base against him, and so that could have been a check mark against Mr. Musk in Donald Trump's eyes. He hasn't been moved off DOGE the same way Ramaswamy has, so it clearly isn't a true divide between the two of them. But it's just something you got to think about when you're covering all of these big-time power players in Trump world. How is their relationship with the president, and what is their relationship with, like, the voter base? Because those are two very important things in Donald Trump's eyes.
Yeah, I'm going to respectfully disagree in this regard. I think there's I think there is a very different Donald Trump than we saw in the first term. I think July 13th changed him dramatically. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I'm close with Trump. I've met him 5 times. He's been on my show once. But I'm very close to a lot of people in his orbit. And I the media has said Vivek was kicked out of DOGE, and the consolation prize was the governor of Ohio. That, from what I've been told, that's not true. Vivek has political ambitions. He's a very young man. He's very smart. He's very wealthy. And going to be the governor of Ohio could set him up down the road. And I think that that's why he is not doing this now. Elon getting press is just what happens. He's the richest man in the world. Yesterday, the president asked him to go rescue our astronauts. So I do think there is some media trying to conjure up division because, well, the media does a good job of that. And I'm not blaming you necessarily for that. I haven't read enough of your stuff to know that one way or the other. What I do know about you is you've been a doggone good guest, and I hope you will come back again.
Thanks, Ray. I really appreciate the time, and I'd be happy to join you guys again in the future.
Absolutely. We have to run. Christian Daytalk of the Washington Examiner in the room yesterday, and I assume in the room every day when the press briefing happens. We look forward to having you back again.
Take care, guys.
Thank you. It is 8-something. I don't even know what time it is.
IBEW Local 567 and NECA Boston are looking for the best electricians as well as electrical contractors. If you're an electrician or an electrical contractor, we are very excited to speak with you. If you're a licensed electrician, we can offer you state-of-the-art training, the most generous benefits package, and a well-deserved sign-on bonus. As an electrical contractor, we offer you highly skilled electricians, a personalized support system for your business, and many additional opportunities such as training. If interested, and to learn more information about becoming a part of IBEW Local 567, please call our membership development line at 207-786-9770. That's 207-786-9770, extension 103. IBEW 567 wants you to be a part of their team.
Children, 20% of them are on some type of prescription drug.
Kennedy plans to say in his opening statement he's not anti-vaccine or anti-industry. He's pro-safety, but his cousin, Caroline Kennedy, calls RFK Jr. a predator.
Bobby is addicted to attention and power.
She posted it on social media after writing a letter to senators warning them about
his constant denigration of our healthcare system and the conspiratorial half-truths he's told about vaccines.
President Trump wants to reduce the federal workforce, offering buyouts to those who don't want to return to offices.
The new Trump team thinks they could save $100 billion taxpayer dollars because they think that many people, that many federal government employees, are going to reply to an email they got last night with the word resign.
Fox's Peter Ducey at the White House. Those who resign by next Thursday would be paid through September 30th. The president's also readying a new executive order today that would cut federal funding to schools that teach radical gender ideology or critical race theory.